Good morning. It's good to be back up here with you all. Thank you, Stephen, for bringing the word last week. Appreciate you, brother. What motivates you to have hard conversations? Maybe it's sorrow over a friend's sin. Maybe it's just the need for finances, and so you have a hard business conversation. What motivates these hard conversations? One conversation that some men have that's motivated by love, but is also one that men dread, is the "I'd like to marry your daughter" conversation. You know, you've met the greatest woman in the world. You're ready to spend the rest of your life with her. You've fallen head over heels for her. And it doesn't matter if this dad is the nicest guy or he carries a shotgun every time he sees you. It's a scary, it's a daunting conversation. Well, Matt and Abby, two members here, they recently got engaged. Yeah, I'm excited for them. And where are you guys? I pointed over there. Okay, yeah. Matt, raise your hand. Come on, buddy. All right, so Matt and I were meeting a month or so ago on a Wednesday, right? It's a Wednesday. We're just catching up, and he told me that of his intentions that weekend to propose to Abby. And so I was like, oh, man, that's exciting. Like, how'd the conversation with her dad go? He said, yeah, I haven't had that one yet. It was like 2 days away, man. What are you doing? But it's daunting, right? That's a scary conversation. I get it. And he ended up having the conversation. He proposed. She said, yes, it's all good. I don't think her dad had a shotgun with him in that conversation. But those are scary conversations. They make us nervous, but is motivated by love. Well, one of my missionary heroes is Adoniram Judson. Judson lived from 1788 to 1850. And as a young man, God put a passion in his heart for the flame of his life to burn bright in the darkness of Burma, which is modern-day Myanmar. And so, as Judson planned for his future overseas, he knew that if he were to be married, his future wife would need to join him in that sacrifice of leaving friends and family and the U.S. to go burn bright in the darkness of Burma. And so, Judson fell in love with Miss Anne Hasseltine. And as he prepared himself for this dreaded marriage conversation with her father, John Hasseltine, he wrote this letter. He didn't have a conversation. He just wrote a letter. I think he was scared of him. But he wrote this letter to her. "I have now to ask whether you can consent to part with your daughter early next spring, to see her no more in this world, whether you can consent to her departure and her subjection to the hardships and sufferings of a missionary life, whether you can consent to her exposure to the dangers of the ocean, to the fatal influence of the southern climate of India, to every kind of want and distress, to degradation, insult, persecution, and perhaps a violent death. Can you consent to all of this?" Matt, is that how your conversation went, brother? Well, what led Adoniram Judson to make such a bold request? What it gave him that boldness to really make a difficult conversation that much harder by just laying it all out there? And maybe even more amazing, what led John Hasseltine to give his daughter's hand in marriage to Adoniram Judson, and he would never see her again? What led to that? Well, I believe the answers to those questions lie in our passage today. And my prayer for us is that God would use this text, he would use this story to stir up a compassion in us that compels us to be on mission with our King in this world. Last week, we saw that we have a generous God, and that produces a generous church. Today, we're going to see we have a compassionate God that produces a compassionate church, which is the title of today's sermon, if you're taking notes. A compassionate God, a compassionate church. Let's look at Matthew 9:35 together. I started coaching soccer yesterday, five-year-olds. And then my girls had a cross-country meet, so I was yelling all day and feeling it. But Lord help me. All right, verse 35. "And Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction." Now, this is a summary statement. We've heard this basically word for word before back in 4:23 when Matthew was introducing this section that we're wrapping up. And this is giving us an idea of what Jesus has been doing in his ministry. Matthew says he went throughout all the cities and villages. Jesus was on the move. He wasn't just sitting around. He wasn't a king in a palace waiting for things to come to him. He wasn't a politician giving empty promises that he wouldn't deliver on. No, Jesus was out with the people, getting his hands and his feet dirty, walking around and ministering to folks. And notice the scope of his ministry. He went throughout all the cities and villages. We know in this section that he's still in Galilee. Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us that there was about 240 villages and cities in Galilee at that time. So that's a lot of walking, a lot of moving around. Some of you are salespeople. You have maybe a territory or a region that you cover. And because the bottom line of your business is what drives you, you spend your time in those territories in the more populated areas, the bigger cities, the bigger regions. So Pastor Clay, he's an engineer. Clay, where are you at? He's on safety, yeah. Oh, there you are. Hey, buddy. All right, you're an engineer. You have a pretty big territory. You're traveling a lot. I know it covers Kentucky and Ohio and Tennessee, all over the place. Well, Clay, I doubt you do business in Possum Trot, Kentucky, in Marshall County. You ever go there? Yeah. You do? Yeah. Oh, that ruins my whole example. Well, you're a good man. what about Monkey's Eyebrow, Kentucky? Next door. Get out of here. But Dingus, Kentucky? You ever go to Dingus, Kentucky?
No.
Now, well, where'd you get this t-shirt from? If you don't. Come on, Clay. those are small towns. Most people haven't heard of them except for you. Thanks for messing my example up. But you wouldn't go there. There wouldn't be good business there because they're small, they're insignificant. You go to the bigger places, you go to the bigger cities to because you want to make money there. Well, Matthew emphasizes that Jesus is going throughout all the villages, all the towns, all the cities, tirelessly giving himself because no town, no area, no population is too insignificant for him. It didn't matter if the place had Jews or Gentiles, if it was males or females, high social status, low social status, if there was a large population or just two demoniacs on the other side of the sea. Jesus was on the move pursuing people everywhere he went. And what exactly was he doing? Well, look at the verbs in this, the rest of this verse. He was teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. He was teaching, he was explaining, he was helping people understand the scriptures and over against what they were learning from the religious teachers of the time. He was teaching. He was proclaiming the gospel. He was heralding the good news, announcing that the kingdom of heaven had come near, that God's end time salvation had come, that he, the Messiah, was ushering in that age of salvation. He was proclaiming and he was healing every disease and every affliction. Again, notice the totality there, meaning there was nothing too big or too small that he couldn't handle as the Messiah. No ailment, no affliction, no condition, no disease was beyond the scope of the Messiah's work. And as he healed, he was giving a foretaste of how things should be and how things will be in the new heavens and the new earth. He was teaching, proclaiming, and healing. And that's how he was tirelessly spending his time. And Matthew summarizes that for us here in verse 35. But what compelled Jesus to go? What compelled him to serve in this way, village after village? Look at verse 36. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. This picture up here, this is my friend Monsi. Monsi has a big mustache. That's him with Asha. Monsi has a big mustache, a big personality, and a big heart. We first met Monsi in 2013 on a trip to Delhi, and we got to spend time with him and his family and go do ministry alongside him in the slums of Delhi. And when you walk into these slums, your heart just breaks for the conditions of these people. I mean, the slums are overcrowded. These folks, they've taken scrap materials and made makeshift homes. There's a lack of privacy and sanitation. Often the kids don't get a good education because they spend their days trying to make a few rupees to get by. It's just abject poverty, and it breaks your heart. Well, we were there. We wanted to help, but we weren't much help. But thankfully, Monsi and his brother and his wife were. You see, they worked daily in the slums, building relationships with these people who were looked down upon in society. They gave themselves tirelessly to start a school in their home to give these kids an education so they could grow up and learn how to read and write. They advocated for the poor by building relationships with lawyers who helped them get more resources to the slums, like water and food and electricity. They gave themselves week in and week out to this work. And then every Sunday, their house was full of people for a house church service where these Hindu background folks were learning about the true God who, like Munsi and his family, were compassionate towards the afflicted. You see, they saw the afflicted. They were with them. They spent time with them. They saw them. They felt deeply for the afflicted. But they didn't stop there. They were actually doing something for the afflicted. And that is biblical compassion, seeing, feeling, and doing something about it. And that's just like what God has always done. Early in the book of Exodus, we see that God's people had been slaves for a long time. They're in a bad place, and it was only getting worse, as we see in chapter Exodus 2, verse 23. During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. Years upon years in chains, years upon years of oppression, feeling forgotten by God, years of affliction. And how would God respond? Verse 24, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. See, God saw their affliction. He felt pity for them as their groans and their cries came up to his ears. And he, who would later reveal himself as the Lord, compassionate and gracious, he knew that he would do something, and he did. In compassion, he delivered his people from slavery. God's compassion is his goodness expressed towards those who are afflicted, to those who are in need. And the consistent revelation of God throughout the Old Testament is that in spite of his people's sin, in spite of their wickedness, in spite of their waywardness and their rebellion, God sees them, he feels for them, and he does something about their affliction. God is compassionate. Psalm 103, verse 13, as a father shows compassion to his children, so the Lord shows compassion to those who fear him. Like a loving father or mother who's in the house and hears the cry of their children outside, and they run outside to go figure out what's going on. God is a God who moves towards the afflicted. He moves toward the hurting. He moves toward the needy because he is compassionate. And as the story of Scripture progresses, we see that there's these forward-leaning promises, this expectation of God to one day be compassionate, again, towards his people. In the book of Micah, God promises that this Messiah will come and he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord. And then in chapter 7, verse 19, he says this, he will again have compassion on us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. You will cast all our sins into the depths of the sea. So this Messiah to come, he would come and shepherd God's people and have compassion on them and deal fully and finally with their sins one day. It's forward-leaning expectation of God's compassion. And so when Jesus shows up on the scene and begins ministering in Galilee, Matthew shows that Jesus is the answer to those longings. Jesus, in Jesus, all those promises come together. Verse 36, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Jesus saw the crowds. He spent time with them. He knew what they were experiencing and what they were going through. And that led to him feeling compassion. The word for compassion here is strong emotional language. It reflects a deep guttural response to need. His heart went out to the people who were afflicted. The same word used here for compassion is used to describe the Good Samaritan who saw the man who was half dead, felt compassion for him, and then went and did something about it and helped him. The same word for compassion here is used to describe the father in the story of the prodigal son. When the son was a long way off, the father saw him. And then in compassion, felt compassion for him and went and met him on the path and embraced him in love. That's the language here. He sees and he feels and he does something about it. And that's what Jesus is doing in this passage. He saw the crowds. He felt compassion for them. And I want to pause here and visit what my hope and my prayer for this sermon is, which was that God would use us to cultivate compassion in us that compels us to be on mission with our compassionate King. And I want to apply this to our lives. What we've seen so far in the passage should come to bear on our lives. Like, and one challenge I want to give you all is, in order to cultivate compassion in your lives, is to, like Jesus, practice the ministry of presence. I believe when we practice the ministry of presence, it's going to stir up compassion in our hearts. As we've seen, Jesus was regularly pursuing people. He was going village to village, town to town, spending time with people, hearing what they were going to. And for us, it's hard to have compassion on people you never see. It's hard to have compassion on people you never spend time with, that you never get to know. Or if you are around people, you're not present with them. You're not aware of what's going on. You're on your phone, or you got earbuds in, or you're just quickly trying to get out of that conversation. It's hard to have compassion on people that you're not present with. The ministry of presence says people are valuable, that they're worth your time, that you're not just here for yourself. The ministry of presence says, I'm going to inconvenience myself for the sake of others. It means being uncomfortable in uncomfortable situations in order to bring comfort to other people. So I want to challenge you guys to practice being present with people that you're normally not around. Put yourself in situations in your neighborhoods or with the families of your kids' sports team or at a restaurant or in a park, and be intentional, show up, ask questions, be aware, listen to what people are going through, ask good questions, and see what comes from it. I guarantee you, the more time you spend with others, being present, being aware, asking those questions, seeking to understand, the more the Lord is going to use that to stir up compassion in your heart for the lost. So cultivate compassion by practicing the ministry of presence. All right, so Jesus saw the crowds. He was moved by their condition. And what was that condition? Well, it says they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd, literally torn and thrown down. The sheep have been ravaged. They're confused. They're lost. They're dying. That is their condition. But how? What happened to the sheep? On Friday, I went out with my kids in the backyard to try to put up a gate in front of our compost pile because our dog Dash keeps getting into it, eating the scraps, coming back in our house and puking. So that's great. So I'm driving this fence post in the ground and I realize I put it in upside down, so I pull it out and all these yellow jackets start flying out. Yeah, so I got stung one sting on the leg and I was like, that really hurts, and she swatted it off, ran inside with the kids, and after a couple minutes my legs start swelling up. I'm like, that's not good. And then I just could not stop itching. Like my ears, my head, I started getting bumps everywhere, bumps on my back, my neck. After a short while, I started getting dizzy, and then I was starting having trouble breathing. We're like, Joe, this is not good. We need to go. So we packed all the kids, go to the ER, and that one little sting, that one tiny sting, put this poison in me, and the effects were presenting all throughout my body. And if it were not for the EpiPen shot that they gave me and the steroids, it could have ended really badly for me. Well, thankfully, the ER was able to help. But one little sting did that to me. Well, in a similar way, when Jesus looked out over the crowds, he saw the ways that the poison from the original sting of sin that happened in the garden so long ago, how that poison had spread and was presenting in many ways throughout all of his good creation. I mean, he could look out and he saw the effects of the original sting of sin in the corrupted world that needed restoration. He looked out and could see the effects of that original sting of sin and the affected bodies and minds of the crowds that needed a remedy. He could look out and see the effects of that original sting of sin and the sinful choices that each and every individual in that crowd had made in their rebellion against God, and they needed redemption. You see, Adam, our representative, rebelled against God, and like father, like son, we have all gone astray, showing that sin's poison courses through our veins from birth. And this poison, it presents itself in pride, selfishness, ingratitude, idolatry, theft, murder, coveting, wickedness, deceit, envy, disobedience to parents, foolishness, drunkenness, divisiveness, jealousy, sensuality, lust, adultery, sexual immorality, practicing homosexuality, obscene talk, lying, slander, gossip, hating God, and hating neighbor, on and on and on and on. The effects of that original sting of sin present themselves in the lives of each and every human being, separating us from God and leaving humanity harassed, helpless, ravaged, and dying from the poison. And just as there was nothing I could do to stop the effects of that poison spreading throughout my body, so mankind is unable on our own to cure this deadly sin problem. This is the condition of man. We're harassed, helpless, ravaged, desperately in need of a spiritual EpiPen, if you will. We need redemption. And that condition of mankind compelled Jesus. But lastly, Jesus could look out and see the effects of that original sting of sin and the failure of Israel's leaders who needed to be rebuked. They needed to be rebuked. The simile here, like shepherd without a sheep, speaks as much to the sinful religious leaders, the shepherds, as it does the sinful individual sheep. In Ezekiel, the Lord used the same language to describe Israel's leaders and how they had completely failed the people. Look at chapter 34, verse 2. Ah, shepherds of Israel, who have been feeding yourselves, should not shepherds feed the sheep? You eat the fat, you clothe yourselves with the wool, you slaughter the fat ones, but you do not feed the sheep. The weak you have not strengthened, the sick you have not healed, the injured you have not bound up, the strayed you have not brought back, the lost you have not sought, and with force and harshness you have ruled them. He's talking about the shepherds, the religious leaders of Israel. The leaders had abused their power. They took advantage of the sheep and used their power for their own selfish gain. They didn't care for the weak, the sick, the hurting, or the vulnerable. But in a compassionate response, God goes on to say in the passage that he himself would rescue the sheep, that he himself would deal with the corrupt shepherds, and that work would ultimately come through the Messiah. So Jesus, the Messiah, the good shepherd, walked from village to village, and he saw this condition of man. He saw that original sting of sin was presenting itself in a world corrupted by sin, by bodies and minds corrupted by sin, individuals corrupted by personal sin, and leaders who failed to care for God's people. He saw this, he felt this deeply, and he had to do something about it. And ultimately, he would. So ultimately, he would lay his life down to be the remedy and to redeem his people from the poison of sin. That's where the story is going. But for now, he's calling lost sheep to himself by going town to town, village to village, teaching the scriptures, proclaiming the kingdom, healing every disease and every affliction, because he understood the condition of the crowds, harassed and helpless, and he was compelled by compassion. He was on the move. Which leads to our second way that we can cultivate compassion in our lives in order that we might be on mission with the King, which is this: be mindful of our shared condition. Be mindful of our shared condition. After my dad was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and we came back to be with him, we spent a lot of time at Ohio State's Cancer Hospital up in Columbus. And I hate hospitals, I don't like being there, but I love my dad. And so I spent a lot of time that season just sitting with him, waiting for appointments, waiting for test results, and holding out hope for good results. You know, and being in a cancer hospital so much, you start to see people differently. Everyone was in there, you know, for a bad reason. No one comes to a cancer hospital to have a baby or anything. There's no celebrations happening. It's just, people are just there, and it's just sad. It's sad. And the longer you're there, the longer you understand what people are going through, what they're experiencing. When you see a family walking with their head down, and we've been there. We were just there the other day. You start to see people differently. And I found that I had this common bond with people who were strangers. And over time, as I saw them more and more, it became more like acquaintances. And my heart went out to them. My tears flowed for them. My prayers went out to them because I understood what they, in a small way, what they were going through, because we had similar hardships. And I still, to this day, every time I drive by that hospital, I can't help but be moved by just the memories of what we experienced in that cancer hospital, and just say a quick prayer for those people who are in there, because I know what they're walking through. I know what their families are experiencing. And I think we often lack compassion because we're just not mindful of the harassed and helpless condition of the people all around us. When you're mindful of your spiritual condition apart from Christ, when you understand the depths of your sin, when you're cognizant of the effects of the sting of sin in your life and how it was ruining your life before Christ and how you deserved judgment, but how Jesus stepped in his compassion and redeemed you and took the punishment that you deserve. When you're aware of those things, when it's regularly on your heart and your mind, it gives you new eyes to see the people around you, and you feel compassion for their harassed and helpless condition. When you're aware of your condition and your desperate need for Jesus, it makes you mindful of their reality apart from Christ, that not only are they experiencing right now the harmful effects of that poison that's coursing through their veins, leading to a life without true joy, without true peace, without true lasting flourishing, without purpose. Not only are they experiencing that now, but it makes you mindful of what they will experience one day in eternity in hell apart from God. And so it creates compassion. So be aware, be mindful of your shared condition with the rest of humanity apart from Christ. All right, so we've seen so far that Jesus is going around the towns, and he's present with the people, teaching, proclaiming, and healing. And he did this because he was moved by compassion due to the condition of the lost. And now we'll see that Jesus invites us to join him on his compassionate mission. Look at verse 37. Then he said to the disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into the harvest." The metaphor here moves from flocks to farming, and the scope broadens from the Galilean crowds to the global community. This picture up here, this is one of my favorite pictures that I took during my time in India, and it's up in the Himalayas, and up there they have to cut into the sides of the hills to make terraces for their crops. And up where we live, depending on the season, they would grow wheat or rice, but it was really hard work for the farmers to traverse up these terraces and do their harvesting. Now, imagine if time for harvesting came and there was only one to two farmers to not only gather the produce from these hills, but all of the terraces across the Himalayas of North India. Imagine if there was only a few farmers to cut and gather the wheat, only a few people to do the stacking and the curing that's necessary, only a few hands to do the threshing and the winnowing and the storing of the wheat. I mean, if there are only a few laborers for the harvest, the work would not get done. And that's what Jesus is getting at. Jesus looks at the harassed and helpless in front of him and says, guys, the world is full of people like this. This is what we see in front of us, but the world is full of harassed and helpless sheep. There is a global harvest of people who are lost. There's a global harvest of people who are lost and perishing, not knowing their true God, not knowing their maker, living their entire lives enslaved to sin, worshiping idols, and they'll die without knowing their maker. And Jesus says, we need more workers. The laborers are few, the harvest is plenty. And so what is his solution? He says, pray. Isn't that interesting? There's an urgent need. The world is perishing, harassed and helpless sheep everywhere, so pray. I mean, there's thousands of distinct ethno-linguistic people groups throughout the world who have little to no gospel witness amongst them. And Jesus says, pray. Why does he do that? Well, one, praying reminds us that God is the sovereign Lord of the harvest. See, God is on mission in this world. It's not our mission. We didn't come up with this. God is a God on mission. The very fact that we have the text of Scripture shows that God desires to be known. He is a God on mission, and he has a church for that mission. He has a plan since the beginning to redeem a people for himself from every tribe, tongue, language, and nation. And we who have been redeemed by his grace, we have the privilege, the honor, the joy of joining him in that compassionate mission. It is his world. It is his harvest, the text says, and he is the Lord of it all. And as the Lord, he is the one who changes hearts. So we have to start by praying to him and be reminded that it's his world, it's his harvest, and he is the sovereign Lord, not us. Second, praying is an essential part of the mission. By calling us to pray here, he shows us that prayer is an essential part of the mission. The word here, he says, pray that the Lord would send out, is not the common word used for sending. Just a few verses down in chapter 10, verse 5, the normal word for sending is used when he says the disciples are sent out. That's the normal word in Greek. But this one's different. In fact, this word for send out is the same word that he uses in chapter 10, verse 1. Look at that, when he says that the demons will be cast out. And he called to him his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out. It's the same exact word, and to heal every disease and every affliction. See, Jesus tells the disciples to pray that God would literally thrust out, forcibly expel people into the harvest of the world. Why does he do that? Well, so many people are currently living lives of ease and comfort. People have their own career path. They have their own idea for the future. People don't want to just get up and leave and go do something that's hard and uncomfortable. And so Jesus says, pray that the Lord would forcibly expel, that he would cast these people out to the nations so that the mission of God would advance in the world. We get stuck in our ways. We get stuck in our little bubbles. We get stuck in our comfort zone. And so Jesus says, we got to pray, beg, plead with the Father that he would rip people out of their context and send them to the nations, because the people are harassed and helpless and they need workers. So prayer is an essential part of the mission, because if we're not praying for people to go, people will not go. That's the logic here. Jesus wouldn't say it if it wasn't necessary. So lean into the mystery of prayer, leaning upon a sovereign God, and do what he says. Pray that God would send workers to the world, because if not, they won't go. We need hearts to be changed. We need resources to be unleashed. We need to be a praying people. Pray, because it's an essential part of the mission. Third, praying leads our hearts towards the lost. And that takes us to our third application that helps us cultivate a heart of compassion for the mission. As we are praying for the lost, as we are praying for laborers, our hearts follow those prayers. I encourage you to sign up on joshuaproject.net and sign up for their daily emails. You'll get an email of an unreached people group every day. Every day that'll come to your inbox, you can open it, see some facts about different people throughout the world, and just say a quick prayer for them. And the more you do that, the more you give yourself to participating in the mission through prayer, your heart follows that, and compassion follows that. As you see these pictures of folks, and as you hear that they have no gospel witness, or that there's only a few believers amongst them, your heart is going to follow that, and compassion will as well. You see, we have in Revelation this picture of the end when people from every tribe, tongue, language, and nation will be around the throne. That's not just a wish dream. That will happen. We've been given a glimpse of the end. But God uses means to his ends. And we get to be a part of those means. So may the Lord do that amongst us. There's a pretty well-known story about two Moravian missionaries named Johann Dober and David Nishman. These men had heard about some slaves that were on an island which is now known as St. Thomas, and they had a burden to take the gospel to those people. And so the story goes that these men were even willing, as they were devising a plan of how to get there, they were even willing to sell themselves into slavery in order to go to St. Thomas. They were ridiculed and discouraged by other Christians about this plan, and eventually they got some funding and ended up not having to sell themselves, but they got on the boat, and as they were pulling out of the dock, the story goes that they turned and proclaimed to those who were on the shore, "May the lamb that was slain receive the reward of his suffering. May the lamb that was slain receive the reward of his suffering." It's beautiful. They understood the worth of Christ and the need to go to the nations. But what's often not told about that story is that several years before that, under the leadership of Count Zinzendorf, the Moravians had started what would end up being a 100-year nonstop prayer chain. 100 years, round the clock, day and night, two people at a time from this community were praying that the Lord would send out laborers into the harvest. And the fruit is still felt today. Their faithfulness impacted John Wesley as he was on a boat coming overseas, over to the Americas. The fruit of their lives impacted William Carey, who became one of the, you know, the main influencers of the modern mission movement. Their prayers are still being felt to this day. Prayer is an essential part of the mission, church. We need to lean into that. But not only are we called to pray, as we pray and as our hearts follow that, we're called to go. Called to go. You see, these disciples in chapter 10, we'll get to this next time. Jesus tells them to pray, and then right after this, he says, all right, I'm going to send you out. I'm going to send you out. And I think sometimes we don't want to pray because we don't want to end up getting sent out. But I want to encourage you, church, as you pray, open your hands before the Lord and say, here I am, Lord, send me. You know what's best for me. Whether it's to my neighbors or to the nations, Lord, would you use me for your glory? Would you use me? Pray and be willing to go, to see and to feel and then to do, to see the harassed and helpless, to feel compassion for them and then to do something for them physically and spiritually, to serve those in need because the compassionate King has invited you to be on his mission in this world. And it's a privilege for us, church. It's a privilege. Earlier, I read that proposal letter from Adoniram Judson to John Hasseltine and asked the question, like, what led him to do that and what led John Hasseltine to give his daughter's hand in marriage? But I didn't read the rest of the letter, and I want to do that now. Can you consent to all of this for the sake of him who left his heavenly home and died for her and for you, for the sake of perishing immortal souls, for the sake of Zion and the glory of God? Can you consent to all this in hope of soon meeting your daughter in the world of glory, with the crown of righteousness, brightened with the acclamations of praise, which shall redound to her Savior from heaven, for heathen saved, through her means, from eternal woe and despair. What compelled them? It was love for God and compassion for the lost. May our compassionate God make us a compassionate church, for the sake of his name, among the harassed and helpless, amongst the nations.